From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a group of activists try to stop a train carrying coal through Worcester.
We need to be done with coal. And as our leaders have failed to act, we're doing what must be done.
Also today, the new president of Hampshire College gives us an update on the school's future.
First of all, I think Hampshire is much more stable than people think it was coming out of last spring.
And the holiday season can be challenging for those struggling with eating disorders.
You think of someone with a restrictive eating disorder like anorexia, who's expected to eat the meal with the rest of the family. There could be extra pressures around that when they would rather just avoid the meal altogether.
We'll take your calls on how to find help for yourself or a loved one. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is from a letter from the President of the United States. Dear Madam Speaker, I write to express my strongest and most powerful protest against the partisan impeachment crusade being pursued by the Democrats in the House of Representatives. This impeachment represents an unprecedented and unconstitutional abuse of power by Democrat lawmakers, unequaled in nearly 2.5 centuries of American legislative history. The president released this letter written to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi less than an hour ago. It comes a day before the full House of Representatives is set to vote on 2 articles of impeachment. With more is Kimberly Atkins, senior news correspondent, joining us from Washington. Hey there, Kimberly.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Kimberly, what's in the letter?
Yes. So this letter, it's a 6-page single-spaced letter that was released by the White House that reads very much in line with the president's tweets over the past several months over the course of the impeachment inquiry. It is full of grievance and anger. It is really scathing and really tries to portray the entire impeachment proceeding, the entire process, as a partisan witch hunt carried out by the Democrats. There isn't really anything new in the letter that we haven't heard the president say before, but what really is astonishing and what he says in his last sentence is that it really seems like this is the president wanting to go on record in history at voicing every objection that he has voiced in every press conference, every tweet in a 6-page letter that he knows will be included in the history books.
Just to add a little more perspective, another quote from the letter, quote, "You are the ones interfering in America's elections. You are the ones subverting America's democracy. You are the ones obstructing justice. You are the ones bringing pain and suffering to our republic for our own selfish personal, political, and partisan gain," referring again to Speaker Pelosi and the Democrats in the House. It's weird to ask you, is it unusual to see a letter like this? Because impeachment is unusual. But in the realm of unusual, how surprising is it to have the president release a letter like this the day before the vote?
Yeah. So yes and no. If you look back in history, whether it was the proceedings leading up to President Nixon's resignation or the impeachment of Bill Clinton, you don't see a letter like this in those situations. You definitely saw the presidents defending themselves. So it is unusual to have this kind of scathing personal letter that is filled, frankly, with a lot of inaccuracies. It is not unusual for Donald Trump. Like I said, it reads very much like the statements he's already made. And that piece that you read is very much in line with how he defends himself in the face of anything, including this impeachment, which he accuses those accusing him of the same thing. One of the charges is obstruction of justice. He says the Democrats are obstructing. One is abuse of power. He says the Democrats are abusing power. Everything that he's accused of, he throws back to the Democrats in what I like to call the I'm rubber, you're glue approach.
So, Kimberly, I'm sorry to laugh, but that's funny even in this kind of really serious moment. So what comes next now? Does this color what happens tomorrow? Will anyone say that this was inappropriate? Appropriate legally, given that there's a vote pending? I mean, how do we process what this means today in the context of tomorrow?
Well, what this shows, obviously the president has every right to send a letter to the Congress, but what Democrats will undoubtedly do is use this as another piece of evidence that the president, A, doesn't believe that what he did was wrong, even though they say that it was, and that the threat is ongoing and immediate. We know Rudy Giuliani is still working on behalf of the president to get what he calls information investigations from Ukraine. It only fuels the Democrats' message that this is urgent, this can't wait for the 2020 election, and that this president should be removed. And this gives us a piece of a preview of how the president will defend those charges.
All right. This story is just breaking. We're still trying to understand the implications of this letter legally, politically. So stay tuned for more from WBUR. Kimberly Atkins, our senior news correspondent, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Let's turn now to a story that is closer to home. That's the sound of a New Hampshire-bound freight train carrying coal last night through West Boylston near Worcester. About a dozen climate activists stood in its way trying to block it, but eyewitnesses say it didn't stop for them. No one was injured. WBUR environmental reporter Miriam Wasser was there and joins us here in Studio 3. Miriam, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So, Miriam, what happened?
Yeah, so at about 8 o'clock last night, a group of maybe close to 25 people or so walked out to the tracks. They were about a quarter mile from Temple Street in West Boylston, where the tracks cross Temple Street. They got out to their location and spent about an hour and a half kind of mentally preparing to block this train. Some people pitched tents, saying that they intended to stay there for the long haul. And then around 9:30, the crew got word from folks who were further down the train or down the track line that the train was coming. So they all kind of ran onto the tracks and gathered together. Some people had banners. Everyone was wearing headlamps. They had a lot of flashlights pointing at the train. And they just kind of waited. And, you know, the sound of the horn was getting louder and louder. And within a few minutes, you could see the faint glow of the train coming from a distance. It was a very slow few minutes there, I'd say. And then shortly before 9:50, the train came into view. The horn was just deafening. It was just blaring nonstop. I think that cut we heard earlier was from when it was still minutes away. So the train passed two groups of people who were waving flags. It passed a bunch of flashlights that the activists had put down on the tracks. It was really terrifying for a moment there. I thought I was about to see someone hit by a train, which is not what I or anyone there was expecting. And then when the train was about 50 feet away, those on the tracks just kind of jumped off and ran to the side. Some people kept running alongside the train and ahead of it, maybe trying to continue to stop it, but the train kept going. And, you know, these trains are really, really long. So I wasn't counting cars, but it took about 7 minutes for it to pass. So people were pretty, there's a lot of emotion going on. Let's listen to a little bit of their reaction.
How are people feeling right now?
Pissed.
Showing the power that the money has, that's running this country.
Well, I'm thinking, would they have just run them over if they didn't get out of the tracks?
Like,
honestly,
what the f- wouldn't have had an option?
Yeah.
Sure, looked like
if we
it.
Were locked to the tracks, they wouldn't have had time to slow down by the time they saw us. They went through two sets of flags knowing that there'd be people down here. We could have been locked down. They didn't know.
So you can hear the nervous energy, the adrenaline in everyone's voice. I think everyone was a little bit shocked, and I know I was.
Miriam, I have to ask, did the train know that there were people on the tracks in advance, and have you heard anything from the train operator about this?
So we have not heard anything from the train operator. I've called them multiple times today, but they haven't gotten back to me yet. So according to the activists, yes, those operating the train did know. They had groups of people stationed ahead, and one of those groups was responsible for calling an emergency dispatcher when they saw the train coming. So the guy in charge of this was a guy named Jacob Pausner, and he says he was about 3.5 miles ahead of where the blockade was and that the train was moving slowly when he called in the dispatcher. He told me that he read this statement to the dispatcher. This is an emergency. There are protesters on the track of the Worcester Main Line near milepost 7. I repeat, you need to stop the train on the Worcester Main Line. There are protesters on the track near milepost 7.
And again, the protesters don't believe that the train intended to or did slow down so as not to strike them.
Correct.
So why were they there? What's the context here? What were they protesting?
In short, they're protesting burning coal in New England. And specifically, they want to shut down the Merrimack Generating Station in Bow, New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. So it's one of three remaining coal-fired power plants in New England. And it's the largest one without a planned shutdown date.
How unusual is it, Miriam, for people to stand on train tracks to try to stop a train in protest? I was really struck by that this morning.
I don't have any statistics for you. I'm not sure how often something like that happens. I can tell you that this was not the first time that this group did that. Earlier this year, actually about a month ago in December, they did a similar action along three different points on this train line. So they stopped it in Worcester, they stopped it in Ayr, and then they stopped it in Hooksett, New Hampshire. So they were modeling last night's demonstration after that first one. And in that first one, they called the emergency dispatcher at each place, and the train did stop. So that's what they thought was going to happen last night.
Did you have a chance to talk to any of the organizers about why they're using this method or you know, explaining it in any way?
Yeah. I mean, a number of people that I talked to just said that they don't, you know, they started their careers trying to make change from the inside, and they just weren't getting anything done, and they felt that they needed to escalate their tactics. And for some people, that means laying their bodies down in front of a moving vehicle, that climate change is this important, and we need to change our energy system.
I think we might actually have some sound from one of the organizers, Tim DeChristopher.
Yep.
Let's hear that.
At this point in time, in this place, this is just what needs to be done. We need to be done with coal. And as our leaders have failed to act, we're doing what must be done.
So this is not now just a local story, Miriam. This went national. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I was the only outside reporter there. And last night it got picked up by Fox News.
The National Fox News.
Yep. And they wrote a story. The story is pretty straightforward. It was just based on the information I relayed in the tweet. I would say the reaction by Fox readers, though, has been not so civil. You know, while some commentators said that they disagreed with the tactics that the protesters used, others went as far as to say that they wish that the train had run them over and that they deserved to be hit by a train. Some people were calling the activists terrorists. A lot of people used words that we can't repeat on the radio. And overall, what I think is really interesting is that most of the online chatter has just been about the tactics, not whether we should still be using coal in New England.
And how much coal do we use in New England?
Not a lot. It plays a very, very small role in our electricity generation, about 1%. And that's down from 18% in 2000. So coal plants really are shutting down. But as I mentioned earlier, there are still three that are left in New England. And this one up in Bow is the biggest one without a planned shutdown date. So the protesters have really been focusing on shutting it down and moving away from fossil fuels.
So what happens next now?
Well, those the protest last night, when I left, they all said, "We'll see you soon. This isn't the last time we're going to do this. They're committed to continuing to do this until they get what they want, I guess."
All right. We will keep watching with you. That is Miriam Wasser, reporter for WBUR's environmental team, Earthwhile. Thank you, Miriam, and I'm glad you're safe.
Thanks, Tiziana.
All right. Stay with us. Coming up, the new president of Hampshire College gives us an update on the school's financial situation and talks about the future of higher education in America. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Last winter, the future looked bleak for Hampshire College. Then President Miriam Nelson had announced that the school was not going to be accepting a freshman class, and the best case scenario for the school's survival seemed to be some sort of merger with a larger college or university. Since then, Hampshire has raised new money and kept its academic accreditation. Ed Wingenbach, Hampshire's new president, stopped by our studio recently with an update.
First of all, I think Hampshire is much more stable than people think it was coming out of last spring, as has been confirmed by our recent accreditation decision. We have a clearest plan for financial sustainability. We are currently fiscally sustainable. We're not facing any immediate crisis at this point. For me, Hampshire College is the most important educational institution in America because it's the place that is charged by its mission to create the next iteration of what higher education should be. It was founded in the 1970 by the five colleges, specifically with the mission to invent and transform higher education, and has done so really successfully.
So you've redone your curriculum just in the last couple of months. So what are you saying higher education should look like right now?
If you imagine what skills students need to be prepared for the world that they face, a world that's full of unknown and ambiguous challenges, where the jobs that they will have 10 years from now don't exist and you can't imagine them, where they have to be able to organize themselves and grapple with big questions, you would not organize college the way most places do, right? You wouldn't think about it in terms of majors and sort of miniature versions of graduate programs. You would ask students to do exactly the sort of thing that they're going to do when they leave college. So what we do at Hampshire College is invite students to work on questions or projects across 4 years that do not have disciplinary limitations, where you come to us with a question that you want to pursue about the world or about how to change it, and you draw from all of the various disciplines and programs that are available at the college and in the five colleges broadly to articulate what that is. And
is that how it's going to work for students when they come out and they come into the workforce, though? I mean, if you are in programming, you actually are going to work in a disciplinary, restricted environment. You're not going to have access to your whole workplace. That's just one example. So how do these skills translate over in a more contained environment, which is what many students will have when they graduate?
Right. Well, I think there are two different kinds of jobs that students prepare for. There's the kind of vocational and very clearly defined jobs. You know, programming might be one of those, some engineering, right? There are places like that. And if you know exactly what you want to do, then you should go train for that. But I think most people who choose to go to a liberal arts education do so with the understanding that they will have many careers over time, and that what they want out of that education is the development of the entrepreneurial skills and the ability to ask important, unthought of questions, gather resources, put together teams of people, and pursue those projects independently. And that's at the core of what a Hampshire education gives you.
So that's a new curriculum model. It would not be new to you to hear that there are those who are calling into question the overall liberal arts college model, that sort of $50,000 tuition in a four-year institution in a self-contained campus where you live there 9 months out of the year, where tuition is escalating and you both have to rely on that tuition, 87% of your revenue comes from tuition, but also have to discount it so that families can afford it, is eventually going to become a math problem that doesn't work anymore. How do you think about that? You are sort of the standard bearer for the smaller liberal arts institution, at least in New England, if not nationally.
Right. So the two things I'd say really quickly about that. The first is that that's not a new problem. Hampshire, when it was founded, one of its charges, apart from inventing the new curriculum of higher education, was to demonstrate that it was possible to offer a rigorous liberal arts education relying primarily on tuition. In our case, we assume that the cost of education for us will continue to be stable or go down because we provide access to a lot of students.
I really want to check this because I know that there are potentially parents and students thinking about applying. You said it's important for costs to go down. I haven't heard anywhere that tuition is going down for students year over year to get a college education. So how are you making costs go down?
This is like the airlines, right? So tuition versus cost. Cost for private colleges nationally has declined about 1.5% a year.
Define
every
cost.
Year. What a student pays.
What a
for
student
tuition,
actually pays.
Yeah, tuition, room, board, books, those sorts of things. The National Association of College Business Officers does a survey of this every year of all of the private colleges and what students actually pay to attend. And that's been, from the point of view of the colleges, it's been an ongoing problem, the problem you're identifying here, which is that the cost has continued to go down, even though tuition, which is, you know, again, it's kind of like an airline ticket, tuition goes up, costs stay relatively stable or they go down. And then you've got as a college, your costs are probably going up. And so you've got to figure out how to square that circle.
You know, the National Association of College and University Business Officers says that the tuition discount rate. So this is what we take off of what we say you're supposed to pay, that you do actually pay, is near 50% for the first time. Is that sustainable? If the cost of the university are going up, but we discount for students what they pay on average to 50% of what a full price student would pay. And the top tier colleges, we had an author, Paul Tuff, on recently, who talked about sort of the giant sucking sound of the very top tier colleges trying to grab as many of the students who can pay full price as possible. Hey, not everybody's going to make that math problem work. They're just not.
Yeah.
How's Hampshire going to make that math problem work?
Right. Well, Hampshire's already makes that problem work.
Explain
that. Coming out of last spring, we adjusted our budget and our expenses in really creative ways, in part by turning to our staff, our faculty, our alums, and saying, you know, in the way that we do at Hampshire, here's a problem. Let's work together to solve it. We now have a budget that, had we taken a class coming out of last spring, we would be producing positive revenue.
Right? So then why was Hampshire close to merging in order to stay alive, and with students sitting into the president's office for 60 days back in the spring?
I think there were real concerns of previous leadership about the trend line, where if you see over the course of several years, you're spending more money and your revenue is going down, and that projects out into the future. Both of those lines look the wrong direction. If you don't think you can control your expenses and you don't think you can raise enough money to make up that gap, then it would have been the right thing to do to try to do something like merge. It turns out that both of those assumptions are wrong, right? We've been able very clearly and effectively to control our costs without undermining our educational effectiveness. And our alumni and other people and parents and other people who care about Hampshire poured out with support financially. And so we've raised, since January of this year, we've raised $11.2 million to support the college.
So here actually is Ken Burns. We talked to him last May. He's an alum. When it looked like Hampshire was in some pretty serious crisis, he took over as co-head of the development effort. Here's what he said.
I identified for myself a figure that really hurt, a contribution that would really hurt, and then I multiplied it by four. And I've reached out to the Hampshire community and asked them to do the same. If you can give $1,000, give $4,000. If you can give $250,000, give $1,000,000.
That's a lot of pain for alumni. Would a five-year chunk, is there a bolus that an institution like Hampshire needs? And if you can get that bolus and then make some changes, you can stabilize? Or will you need alumni to be thinking, man, $1,000 hurts and I got to give $4,000? For the rest of the institution's life.
So, 2 points about that. We just launched a campaign last week. Ken is the co-chair of that, along with several other people. The campaign is for $60 million over 5 years. So we're raising that money to make up the gap between not having taken a class this year, which costs some revenue.
13 incoming students for this current year versus a standard class of 300?
350, right. And so over the course of the next 4 years, when we return to full enrollment, at our current budget levels, we will have a balanced budget. Actually, we'll be producing positive revenue. But to get from here to there, we have a hole to fill. Once we get to the next 4 years out, if we can continue to raise money, it will be to build other opportunities for our students on top of our core operations. Right now, we just need to get from here to there.
There's some data that suggests that I think I laugh out of the irony of it, not because it's funny. I think the term that's been used is the coming apocalypse in 2026, where it seems like the demographics of college age young people will just tank in most regions of the country. So that business model you just talked about, or that financial model, is predicated on keeping that 300-person enrollment. Are you worried? Are you worried about this apocalypse of shrinking demand right at the moment that higher education institutions, these liberal arts colleges, need to be able to keep people in the seats?
I'm not for Hampshire. I'm worried for it generally. Hampshire's in the lucky position is that we have a national reputation. We recruit from California, from the Pacific Northwest, from Florida, from the South, internationally. So our pool of students is much broader and deeper than just New England. And this is, you know, you'll go back to talking to college presidents of small colleges. What they're all concerned about between now and 2026 is, how do we identify the clear spot for us in the market where we can attract 400 or 500 students out of all of the 18-year-olds that are out there who want to come to us. And in some ways, for liberal arts colleges, this is actually an easier math problem. Just about 3% of traditionally aged college students go to liberal arts colleges. If 4% went to liberal arts colleges, every liberal arts college in the country would be fine, right? So the denominator is different here. If we can just move it a little bit, even of a shrinking pool of students, liberal arts colleges can survive. If they're willing to figure out what they do well, what their niche is, and invest their resources to support that, the ones that do that are going to be fine.
All right, before we go, I do want to spend just a minute talking about equity. It may be counterintuitive to some of our listeners to know that actually one might be more likely to get an attractive financial aid package as a low-income student or maybe a first-generation student from a private liberal arts institution than from a state school.
That's absolutely true. So, in fact, we have more moderate and low-income students at at Hampshire College than any of the other schools that we're consortium with, including UMass Amherst, and by a significant amount.
And so that creates an equity imperative that liberal arts institutions like yours figure this out.
Yes.
We know we need our young people of color, our low to moderate income families, our first generation college goers to go. So do you feel a burden of equity in solving this problem for Hampshire College as well?
Yeah, I think it is the essential question for private higher education. I think it's a bifurcated question that there are places that have immense resources that could make a very quick difference should they choose to do so.
And it, you talk about top-tier institutions
I will just give you an example of one of the places that I think should be a model for how we think about private liberal education. One is Hampshire because of the way we do the curriculum. The other for me is Berea College in Kentucky, which has a $1.6 billion endowment, but they spend all of it on student support. So they only admit low-income students. No one there pays tuition. And if you visit Berea College, it doesn't feel like a place that has $1.6 billion, but they're doing an immense amount of good for the world, right? On the other side is the majority of small private colleges that are in situations similar to Hampshire, where our revenue comes from our students. And in our case, what we need to do and what we've been doing is try to match the resources that those students, particularly first-generation students, lower-income students, students from ethnic and racial minorities, need to be supportive, and then make sure that they don't have to borrow an excessive amount of money in order to graduate. I think that is a good model for how this works. And so our typical graduate leaves Hampshire College with a roughly $25,000 in debt, right? It's the price of a used pickup truck. Well, for an investment that is likely to pay off with, you know, $1 million or more in added income over the course of your life, that's a pretty good investment.
That's Hampshire College President Ed Wingenbach. Stay with us. Coming up, during the holidays, supporting yourself or someone you love who has an eating disorder. We'll talk about it and take your calls next at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And listeners, as we start, I want you to know that this next segment focuses on eating disorders, if that's a subject that's particularly difficult for you. The holidays are a time for friends and family and food. For those who struggle with an eating disorder, it can be a time of pain and stress, and it's a feeling that can last year-round. So joining us to talk more about the challenges of the season and resources available to help is Dr. Holly Peek, Assistant Medical Director of the Klarman Eating Disorder Center at McLean Hospital. Dr. Peek, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Jessie Felber, a master's student studying social work at the University of New Hampshire. She has also recovered from anorexia nervosa. Jessie, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
We want to invite you to pull up a chair at the table, listeners. This is a hard subject, but one that can be helpful to talk about, to ask questions about, to think about for your loved ones or family members. Call us. What do you want to know? What stories do you have to share? How can you find help? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Dr. Peek, I'm going to start with you. I have a few questions for you, and then, Jessie, I'm going to turn to you to share some of your story. Dr. Peek, how does one diagnose an eating disorder? What are signs to look for?
Yeah, so I think the first thing to know is that eating disorders can come in many shapes and sizes. And so in order to be diagnosed with an eating disorder, you should really go see a medical professional. But the three eating disorders we really think about are anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and binge eating disorder. So anorexia nervosa is mainly characterized by someone who restricts food intake to the point that they have a low body weight and are can be quite malnourished. They may do other compensatory things that can also impact their body weight, like excessive exercise, purging, laxative use. But the main characterization of it is the malnutrition and low body weight. When we think of bulimia nervosa, those people can be characterized as a pattern of binge eating and purging. They may or may not be low body weight, and typically they aren't low body weight. And so it's hard to kind of see on the outside. Both with anorexia and bulimia, psychologically, people often have an overvaluation of their body shape and size.
Meaning they overemphasize or overfocus on it?
Overfocus on it, yes. They may have a thin ideal in their mind of something that they want to look like or something that they're striving for. And so that can be a psychological basis of how anorexia and bulimia can be developed. We also have binge eating disorder, which is quite different than anorexia and bulimia. People with binge eating disorder can often be overweight or obese, and they don't have the same sort of compensatory mechanisms people use to lose weight. It's just strictly binge eating.
So, Dr. Peek, my understanding is that often people seek to hide the signs that might be telling to their loved ones or their friends or family
Absolutely.
That they're experiencing an eating disorder. So what are those signs? How does one look for or see them?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that with eating disorders, often there can be a lot of shame and secrecy involved. And so it can be often hard for loved ones to see what's going on. But if you have a loved one who seems like they're avoiding eating with others, they may not be enjoying doing the same things they used to be doing. Food and socializing with eating can be a very common thing in our culture. People with an eating disorder might start avoiding those things. Or if you see a loved one have a significant amount of weight loss in a short amount of time, that could certainly be a warning sign as well.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Elisa in West Roxbury is ready to pull up a seat at the table. Thank you for calling, Elisa. What would you like to share with Dr. Peek and Jesse?
I had an eating disorder, but I also say I still have one. I recovered from anorexia and bulimia, and I just think it is important during this time of year that people just keep diet language just as a very private thing and not something they may be talking about at work or in front of others, and to make sure you aren't food policing other people as well. If you think you should say something about what people are eating, you probably shouldn't.
Thank you for that. I really appreciate you sharing your story, Elisa. And actually, this is a time to, I think, to turn to Jesse. You've recovered from anorexia nervosa. Thank you for being willing to share your story. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, thank you for giving me a platform to share about what my journey has looked like. So for me, my struggle with anorexia really took off when I entered college. During that time in a person's life, it's such a huge transition. And for me, all of the transitions I was dealing with really manifested in a lot of anxiety that I hadn't dealt with before. This anxiety made it really hard for me to be around my friends, for me to really feel like I was present in the classes that I was in. So as a way to kind of manage that anxiety, I started working very hard in my classes, trying to kind of distract myself from the anxious feelings and insecurities I was dealing with. And this segue is always a little bit awkward to loop in, but at the same time, I was in a college nutrition course, and we completed this project called a diet analysis project. And what you did when you did this project is you had to record everything that you ate for 3 days, and then the project kind of spit out results that told you areas in your diet and exercise regimen that were going well, and then areas that were maybe could be improved. And for me, I was really so used to pushing myself and trying to overachieve in everything I was doing that seeing those results really became an opportunity for me to to try to perfect my diet and exercise. And so began this journey of really hyper-focusing on food, hyper-focusing and obsessing on exercise. And, you know, what started as small modifications to my diet and exercise habits turned into what became anorexia over the course of about 2 years. And by the time that I was in a place that I required residential treatment to really get myself back on track, I was thinking about food and exercise from the moment I woke up to the second that I went to sleep. And it was just really taking away like the parts of my life that were joyful.
Dr. Peek, I see you nodding a lot during that part of Jesse's story. What are your reactions?
Yeah. So, Jesse, when you mentioned that how this started in a nutrition course, that didn't surprise me at all, because I think a lot of eating disorders do start with diets gone out of control. And particularly in this culture where in pop culture, there's all these fad diets and in different ways to achieve X, Y, and Z. Some people are able to diet and let it go. Some people, you know, particularly if they're more prone to anxiety or depression or OCD or have some other sort of things or troubles with transitions, like Jesse was describing, it can kind of take over. So that's not an uncommon story that I hear.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you'd like to join the conversation. And we'd like you to join the conversation. Kim is calling now from Newton. Hi, Kim. What would you like to share with Jesse and Dr. Peek?
Well, I'd like to ask for help. I'm a former runway model. My best friend had bulimia. I now have 3 girls, and I'm in shock over the way the models look in the catalogs that arrive at our house or on Instagram where my girls are all active. The sample size now is known to be a 00. Some of these models that my kids are getting catalogs and bombarded with ads are so skinny, it's scary. And we need to do something about this. I don't see anything happening. I'm just wondering, are doctors aware of this? There's a lot of kids at Newton, for example. They found a recent mental health survey, 30 to 40% feel bad about the way they look. So maybe they're not, quote unquote, you know, having an eating disorder yet that can be treated, but they're certainly in a body dysmorphic or on their way or feeling bad because they don't look like, you know, these extreme versions being held up to them. I'm just wondering, what can we do?
Thank you, Kim, for that question. Dr. Peek?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And I think this is something that we're all aware of and something I see also common, particularly in treatment of adolescents and young adults who are bombarded by media messages really 24/7 now, because with social media and access even on your phone to these thin, idealized messages, it can be really problematic. So, yes, absolutely. I think it's problematic and something we're aware of and tricky to kind of know what to do about it. I think the more and more people in the media are having conversations about it and trying to make a change in the model industry, like you mentioned, I think it can be very helpful, but it's so, so slow going. I think on more of a local place, what we can do within families and really within schools too is more media literacy education. And how can we teach our kids to be more critically analyze the messages they're getting in the media?
Jesse, what about you from your own experience?
Yeah, and I mean, I think this is such a huge topic and something that has a complicated answer. But for me, the reason that I choose to be open about my story and my struggle is because I think the reality is there are a lot more people that have struggled with eating disorders or their relationship with their body, but we just aren't talking about it. Some of the media that's thrown at us as starting from a very young age is so detrimental. But if we're not creating a space for kids to be able to come to adults or people they trust in their life to talk about how ridiculous these images are, then we're not going to be able to show kids that really the expectations they might have for their body aren't healthy.
Jesse, what does that look like when an adult creates a space for a kid to come to them and say, I'm disturbed by what I'm seeing, or I feel bad because I don't look like what I'm seeing? What does that space look like?
I think one of the the best ways to help create that space as an adult is to really be looking at your own relationship with food and your body. So making sure that when you're around children or anyone, that you're really keeping that diet talk limited, that you're talking about food as something that is a fuel for our body, something that has so many benefits. Too often food can be labeled as good or bad when the reality is food is meant to be enjoyed. It serves a purpose for us. It helps. It's the energy that gives us what we need to live lives. And so I think that if we can use more compassionate language about food and our bodies around children, that could be a good way to welcome that conversation.
Dr. Peek, the other thing I thought of when Kim called from Newton, she talked about she's a woman, her friend in Florida was a woman, she talked about her daughters, but young men and men can experience eating disorders as well, correct?
Absolutely, yes. And I think more and more we're starting to recognize that this isn't only a women's health and women's mental health issue. This is an everybody's health and everybody's mental health issue. And I think that it's been so stigmatized that it's a woman's problem that oftentimes men and young boys haven't felt like they had a space to talk about and also haven't been asked the questions either, because the conversation has always been focused on it's a women's health issue. But I think we're starting to recognize more and more that this is something that young men struggle with as well, particularly when you think of like the media messages that we were talking about, wanting to have a particular muscular look. That tends to be kind of the media message that is sent out there, that the body image that men strive for.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Jane is on the line from Concord. Hi, Jane. Do you want to share your story?
Hi. Yes. Thank you for taking my call. This is a subject near and dear to my heart because I'm a mother of a daughter who has had anorexia for 15 years. But there were two points, really, I wanted to make. One is that now as a 30-year-old, she's doing very well. But the first point is that she's doing very well because of all the professional help that she got. And there are things that we would do differently as a family. But one thing we did do, I think, that really made a difference was to make sure that she had therapy. We had therapy. We lined up the doctors. She's been in residential programs, and she's really bought into all of that. So if there are parents listening out there that are worried, that can make such a huge difference.
Jane, I know you had a second point too, but I've got my lines are filling up, and I want to have a chance to pick up on your first point with our panelists. So I'm going to thank you for that, and I'm also going to tell you and I'm glad that your daughter's doing better. How did you know, Jesse, to get help?
It was a very long road. And I think to what the caller had said, it's so important that you get the right level of care. For me, I think I started noticing that I really needed to get more help when I stopped enjoying things in my life that were once enjoyable. I always, whenever I talk about this, I use the example of my nephews and boys that have always brought so much joy in my life. And I remember being with them when I was really actively struggling and not feeling the same joy that I had felt, and not because anything about them was wrong. It was just because I was just so exhausted. So that's when I knew that I needed to call and get a higher level of support, but it wasn't easy living. I'm from New Hampshire. And when I had sought help first, the only treatment center was about an hour away from where I lived, and it had just opened up literally a couple of months earlier. So it was certainly not an easy road.
I want to take a moment to share the National Eating Disorders Association hotline with our listeners. If you are looking for help, one of the numbers you can call is that hotline, 1-800-931-2237. That's 1-800-931-2237. And we do have a list of resources on our website, which is radioboston.org. Dr. Peek, where does someone even start when they are looking for the help for themselves or for a loved one, for a child?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, like the caller mentioned, it often takes a team of professionals to kind of diagnose and treat what's going on in a lot of these patients. But I think the best place to start is with a primary care physician. And I think that for a couple of reasons. Number one is most people have a primary care physician. all kids should have a pediatrician. And a pediatrician can make sure a person is medically stable. A pediatrician and primary care physician could also have resources to refer to a psychiatrist and a psychologist if the patient needs more help in other areas, needs medications. And everyone needs regular therapy, too. I think the caller mentioned that as well. A primary care physician can also refer to a dietitian, because I think dietary counseling is so important also in the treatment of this illness.
I'd like to take another call. We have Joanna, or Johanna, I'm sorry, I don't know which, on the line from Marlboro. Hi, how do you pronounce your name?
Yes, it's Joanna.
Joanna, welcome to the show. What would you like to share?
Thank you. Well, first of all, I just have to say I've been listening, and I feel like everything that's been said is spot on. I am currently a 44-year-old woman who is working towards recovery from an eating disorder that really didn't come on for me until I was 37. So I think it's really important, as you know, we're all talking about this, to realize that it might not just be your adolescence. Everything that the panelists and the callers have said may also apply to maybe your sibling, your cousin, your neighbors, your friends. And we, even as adults, may still need the same level of support. So, you know, supportive conversation, avoiding maybe analyzing food or exercising routines, you know, all of that. In answer to one of the earlier callers, actually, what can we do? We can all work on that.
Joanna, that's such a helpful reminder. Dr. Peek, you look like you wanted to react to that.
Yeah, I just thought that was such an excellent point that she brought up, because I think that the first step is that people need to ask the right questions of people to help people figure out what exactly is going on. And oftentimes, myself, even professionals may have stereotypes in our head of like who is at high risk, and may neglect that to ask someone like men or people in their 30s, like the caller mentioned, to ask the appropriate questions. So I just thought that was such an excellent point.
Let's grab one more call if we've got time. This is Sable from Waltham. Go ahead, Sable.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I wanted to go back to Kim's point earlier. She called and
Kim
asked
from Newton.
About... Yes, the catalogs and her daughters. And like the doctor mentioned, it is really slow movement on like the national scale. However, we do have great tools now to be able to curate our own feeds, like going on Instagram and searching for body positive hashtags, things that are not fat phobic, and really just diversifying your own Instagram feed, your own Facebook feed, and trying to step away from those more popularized ideals.
Thank you for that, Sable. I think that's a good chance to ask Jesse, have you changed your social media or other kinds of consumption, you know, media consumption habits as part of your recovery process?
Yes, I have. I think that when you embark on a journey through recovery, you're really changing a lot about your lifestyle. And so I think that was an excellent point to bring up, to be looking for those body positive hashtags on different media outlets. And so I've changed that. When I was really struggling with my eating disorder, I had a Fitbit that I do not have anymore, because for me, that was a really triggering tool to have on me, and something that really just complemented some of the obsessive tendencies I was dealing with.
So Dr. Peek, we have about a minute left, and I couldn't get to the caller, but we had a caller who wanted advice on how to talk to a child in the middle of treatment for an eating disorder. So I thought maybe you could address that a little bit.
Yeah. You know, it can be such a delicate situation. And I think just allowing a child to have an open space and to feel comfortable within the family or with their support system to be able to talk about anything and everything that is bothering them. And I think just creating that culture within your family is really important too, and kind of set the basis that it's okay to ask for help and to seek help from mental health counselor, psychiatrist, therapist.
Jesse, last quick word for you.
Just that recovery is not a linear process. There are a lot of twists and turns and highs and lows, and to be willing to walk through that with your child that might be struggling.
With that is Jesse Felber, a master's student studying social work at the University of New Hampshire. She also recovered from anorexia nervosa. Thank you, Jesse.
Thank you.
And Dr. Holly Peek, Assistant Medical Director of the Klarman Eating Disorder Center at McLean Hospital. Thank you, Dr. Peek, for coming in.
Thank you.
One more time, listeners, you can find a list of resources on our website, radioboston.org. And the National Eating Disorders Association hotline is 1-800-931-2237. Lastly, WBUR will be talking about eating and health as part of a new podcast called Food, We Need to Talk, which explores how we can improve our relationship with food. The podcast comes out next week, but you can actually listen to a preview of it on our website now at radioboston.org, and you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts. So that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.